Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr, and this week we will be reflecting on the jump season that was, concluding at the weekend with Willie Mullins' historic triumph in the British Trainers title and just about everything else aside. However, we've got lots of ground to cover this week beyond that, including Lee Motorsed's report in Sunday's newspaper about unrest at Britain's biggest racecourse group, the Jockey Club. And fittingly enough, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by the author of that report, Lee Motorsed. Welcome,
Lee. Good morning.
Good morning. And by Chris Cook. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
Great. We were going to dive straight into Willie Mullins' historic triumph at Sandown. However, we've got some relatively breaking news overnight, which we have to open with, which is the sad death of Shishkin, who fractured a leg in his box at home at Seven Barrows just hours before he was due to leave for the Punchestown Festival. Shishkin was one of the most talented, if mercurial, chasers of his generation, and his 2022 Ascot Chase clash with an Ergamine will live in everyone's memories for many years to come. However, Lee, such sad news. It really sort of caps a horrible spring for Nicky Henderson just when it seemed his fortunes were turning. And many people have been deeply affected by the loss of such a popular, if quirky, chaser.
Yeah, absolutely. It was desperate news to either go to bed to last night or wake up to this morning. And you can see on social media the reaction has been enormous. A platform that can be quite hostile and venomous was actually just full of sadness and sympathy for the horse and his connections. And I think the extent of that underlines the way in which Shishkin had forged a place in the heart of jumps fans. He was, as you say, mercurial. He was a character, something that connections readily acknowledge, but he did also have the most enormous will to win when the fire was burning. And anyone who was at Ascot that day, that 2022 Clarence House Chase, when all the way up the home straight, that was a race he could not win. And Ergamine had him beaten, but from the final fence, he summoned up the courage, the will to win that got him home in front. I was there that day. It was one of the very best days I've experienced at Ascot on flat or jumps. There was tremendous affection for the horse, and even on his naughty days. So the day at Ascot when last season he refused to start, I don't think people were angry towards Shishkin. There were almost smiles of, oh, that Shishkin again. He's done what he potentially could have done.
Well, there's something about horses like that. And in fact, Chris, you've written about it quite a bit, haven't you? About how we enjoy, love, are infuriated by sometimes, but feel very strongly about these sort of characters of the sport.
It's a chance to connect with a horse, I think, when he shows you that he's, you know, thinking and feeling and reacting. Those horses are so much more interesting to me anyway.
There's something human about that as well, that the foibles that you become apparent and that are purely rooted in sort of a personality quirk.
Well, they're not a sort of Pete Sampras, you know, winning automaton, you know, which, I mean, it's exciting up to a point, but it can get relatively boring. You know, Shishkin's just a fascinating character, and I mean, it just really dreadful. It should happen to him, and so unexpected as well. You know, just out of a blue sky, when we were expecting within a couple of days to be seeing him back on the race course, adding real luster to it, what was already an interesting race. It's a great shame. And I remember most from the Supreme, I thought that was an extraordinary run, because he clearly wasn't going to win that. It looked like Abacadabras was home for all money. And he must have gone through the pain barrier to run him down. I always think fair play to a horse that comes back from putting in an effort like that and continues to run to a very high level for years afterwards as well.
Yeah. Talking about winning automatons, we'll turn now to the all-conquering Willie Mullins, who secured his first British Trainers title at Sandown on Saturday. It's quite extraordinary, and I think Willie Mullins' success is so great that at times we can sort of be inured to the historic nature of what he's doing. But you know, two things I think jumping at me here. First of all, he didn't really compete for most of the season. He was 1.5 million behind, two-thirds of the season gone. He didn't get a six-figure haul until Cheltenham Trials Day, and really until Cheltenham and the Spring Festivals, he wasn't really in the race. And then, of course, the fact that nobody has done this since 1954. I always thought this was a bridge too far, even for Willie Mullins, and he's done it quite easily in the end, hasn't he, Chris?
Yeah, he has. I don't hold it against him, but I don't mind at all that he's sort of been a late entrant to the race. I mean, that's the way our season works. There's so much of the money is just stacked at the end. And if you want to be champion trainer, it's measured by prize money. You've got to win all the big races. So it's something, it's a bit like Richard Hughes used to say about the Jockeys Championship. You know, you wait to see what position you're after, Glorious Goodwood, and if you're in with chance then you really go for it. And I guess that's how it's going to be in future seasons if Willie Mullins fancies another go at the title race. It'll be, you know, follow the system that's been working for the early months of the campaign. And then if you get through Cheltenham and have some success at Aintree and you're in the hunt, then at that point you can start firing on all cylinders.
Do we think he'll do that, though?
I mean, that's
there was
my
some
expectation.
New piece on Saturday, that Lee, that you thought he might give it a proper go all season.
Yep.
David Jennings in his Saturday column was writing about how he thought the 5-1 available then was an extraordinary price because Mullins didn't have any serious sort of competition in the early season grade ones. Do we think he'll actually go for it from the beginning next year, or will he continue in this route where sort of after Cheltenham, okay, well, maybe I give it a go now?
He pretty much said at Sandown on Saturday that he would go for it. There'd been hints in things he had said, but he was pretty explicit when I had a one-on-one with him, and he was pretty explicit in that, and he said the same thing on the podium. I think a lot of it stems from this association with Vincent O'Brien. Mm. 70 years ago, Vincent O'Brien became the first Irish-based trainer to become champion of Britain. Mm. That achieving a feat that the man he described as the legend of the game had accomplished meant a lot to Willie. But Willie is also very much aware that Vincent O'Brien did it 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And therefore he hasn't really emulated him until he does do it 2 years in a row.
And then it's 3 years to exceed him.
Yeah. So you know, he used the phrase, "Are you daring me?" when I put that to him. And I think he will take it on. He will be sparing because he's a man who works to systems that do work for him. And traditionally that has been to largely shun, avoid British racing until you get to Cheltenham. Yes, he goes for the King George. Mm. He'd have had odd runners in the
Yeah,
but by and large, he concentrates on Ireland until Cheltenham, and then things change. But I think he would acknowledge, well, you can't not acknowledge, that had Willie Mullins not won the Grand National, he wouldn't be champion trainer. The Iron Maximus
prize. But that was also true for Vincent, in fairness.
Absolutely.
Both years that he was champion, he won the Grand National.
And therefore, I think Willie would realise that for all that the Grand National has changed and his prospects of winning it are now increased, you still can't bank on winning the Grand National.
Sure.
And therefore, if you want to set out your stall to be champion trainer, you probably do need to be engaging in those big Saturday winter races through December, January and February at Cheltenham, at Ascot, at Newbury, at Sandown.
So, I mean, that's where I start to think that's probably not going to happen. I mean, it's one thing to be there in the moment, you know, lapping up the attention and the applause, justly his, and to say, well, this is great, yes, of course, we'll be back. You know, when it comes to laying out plans for particular horses, trainers being such creatures of habit, and when you're a successful trainer, why wouldn't you stick to the habits that worked so well for you? I think his instinct is very much to still follow the established routes through the early stages of the season.
Maybe.
I acknowledge he has so many horses,
well,
you've got to look for other targets.
That's the key. The strength of depth he has in each division is such that he can look at any given weekend and say, OK, well, I've got these two for the big 2-mile novice chase at wherever Leopard stand. I've got these two for the comparable race.
The depth of firepower is extraordinary. Yeah, and the way he just sort of conjured up full teams for Ayer and Sandown when he saw the race was on, it was just, it must have been so dispiriting. It's like seeing another army come over the brow of a hill, isn't it? It's like, where did they come from?
Well, he won the Scottish Grand National with a horse that most of us hadn't even heard of until a couple of weeks before. But Minella Kakuna won the Brett 365 Gold Cup with the best will in the world. He isn't a horse that would be towards the top of the Sutton division. And even in weight for age races, Il Était Temps. We saw what he did at Aintree. Well, he's a very good horse, but he's not a horse that would hold a candle to Gaelic Warrior in a head-to-head, and yet he dotted up.
One of the points David Jennings made in this column on Saturday, I have to admit, I was slightly sceptical when David Jennings said he thought 5-1 was a good price for Willie Mullins winning the title next year, but... he made such a compelling case and pointed to lots of these early season grade ones in Britain and sort of said, well, do you really think Willie Mullins couldn't win that if he wanted to? And you had to concede, you know, he could probably, you know, sort of rustle up one from the back barn to win some of these races.
Yeah.
It's absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, there must be some sort of real concern for British trainers right now about the prospect. You know, we've already seen the likes of Gavin Cromwell come over and plunder some... certainly big races at Cheltenham in the early season. If Willie Mullins decided he was going to have a proper shot at it through the season...
But you've got to give Gavin Cromwell his due. I mean, that's an operation that has also been growing
in
size and quality.
Very much. Gavin Cromwell has done fantastically well to come over and identify these races. But he himself has admitted that one of the reasons he's done it is because
Get away from Willie.
whilst you can argue it wouldn't be great for the participants, and clearly it wouldn't in that sense, although you can also argue that competition is what drives future success. Good horses racing against good horses makes them better horses.
Right.
But the bigger picture...
Well, in that case, we're going to be sorted.
We're going to be
Cheltenham
sorted.
Festival
winners, aren't we? 28 out of 28. I think the bigger picture is that, you know, what we are doing every Saturday is we are putting on an entertainment show. I've said before, it's show business on turf.
Yeah.
And I think a problem with what we've seen in the last few seasons is that racegoers who have been going racing in Britain every weekend, who've been reading the Racing Post every weekend, who've been following the sport every weekend, get to the Cheltenham Festival and they wonder if what they're watching at Cheltenham bears any resemblance to what they've seen all winter long, because different horses are popping up winning the races and makes those winter races in Britain seem almost irrelevant. If we have more of those Clissutton stars competing in those races, it might just make those races feel more relevant and more of a guide to the ones that be watching at Cheltenham and Aintree.
It is a very tempting theory, and I'm almost certain that I've said it myself at times. But there's always been that element, hasn't there? You know, when you get to Cheltenham, the results are different to what you've been seeing through the season, because that was all on deep mud, and then suddenly you're getting good ground in the middle of March. Which is why if you can find the right horse, listeners get paid at a good price. Or that's how it used to be.
But at least in those cases, it was at least the same horses who were racing at Cheltenham in the winter.
You spot it finishing sixth at Plumpton and goes, that's one for the pretemps final. Yeah. Well, maybe.
One final comment on Willie Mullins. I'm going to invite you to say it, Chris, because you wrote a very nice column on Friday sort of recalling the early days of Willie Mullins and reminding everyone that just how far he has come from such humble beginnings.
Well, that's the point. Is there's, you know, you might imagine, knowing that he's the son of Paddy Mullins, who trained Don Ronan and was champion trainer in Ireland himself many times, that, you know, there's an inevitability about Willie's success, but it isn't so. He started out with technically not quite enough horses to qualify for an Irish Turf Club licence in those days. And, you know, had to sort of talk a good game just to get into the game in the first place. And there were years where, you know, he's doing well, but at a sort of low level, and initially with horses that they owned themselves, and would then sell on once they'd done something with them. And there came a point where the decision was, you know, do we carry on like this, or do we hold on to these horses and try and win big races with them ourselves? And look where it's got him. He must still feel that drive from knowing, you know, having had that history, which to him probably seems like 5 minutes ago. There was a much harder time when success was hard to come by. And, you know, the big time winners were not looking his way. He's still sort of taking on every race like it's those times, you know, like 1 foot wrong could be the end of your business. And I think it's worth remembering that if you want to understand, you know, the way he's thinking, the way he operates. He's so genial, isn't he? So easy to sort of get along with and to enjoy his company.
No one has a bad word to say about him.
He doesn't carry himself like an absolutely ruthless sportsman, but that is what he is.
Yeah.
And I think that's why one thing I really picked up on at Sandown on Saturday was there was enormous warmth about the day. You know, all winter long we've had this debate about how British jump racing is faring relative to Ireland and relative to Willie Mullins, but Saturday didn't feel like a day of introspection, of soul searching.
Let's see how long that lasts. Anyway,
enjoy it while enjoy the positivity while it's there.
Can we just say a quick word for poor Dan Skelton, who has
really? But he's not exactly poor, is
he? Not poor. Okay, fair enough. But he has set his targets for so long on eclipsing his old boss, Paul Nicholls,
yeah,
and then finally achieves it and gets sideswiped by the Mullins juggernaut.
Yeah, and it will have hurt on Saturday, albeit I suspect he saw it coming from the moment I Maximus went past the post in front in the Grand Nationals. It wouldn't have been a surprise. But aside from obviously there have been other issues and difficulties for Dan and his stable this season and in recent years, but on the track, this was a significant turnaround season for Dan, in the sense it was a season in which he really did step up a notch. Four winners at the Cheltenham Festival, you can't bank on that every season. But the quality of his horses in general really accelerated. And they will be very hungry to, as they might see it, right that wrong next season and get to the top spot.
And also to cement his place, you know. I mean, it was such a long, long struggle for him to sort of claw his way into touching distance of Paul Nicholls and then to finally eclipse him. And, you know, both he and Paul will be incredibly competitive about winning that sort of, leaving aside what Willie Mullins does, but about establishing themselves as top trainer in Britain.
As will Nicky Henderson, because of course he's had a terrible Cheltenham Festival this season, but we've seen thereafter what the firepower he has at his disposal, and pre-Cheltenham, he was doing really well too. So I think all three will be hungry and competitive, and you know, but at the same time they'll acknowledge the achievement of Willie Mullins, and as Harry Skull said to me on Saturday, his firstborn might even now be christened Willie. Maybe not.
We will leave it there. We could go on for ages. We haven't even had a chance to pay tribute to new champion jockey Harry Cobden or his rival Sean Bowen, both of whom fought out a tremendous race in the jockey's title. But we have to move on. Before our next story, a quick highlight of our brand new race card mode on the RacePost app, SmartView.
Fancy a bet, but find it confusing? Do not fear. SmartView is here to help you. We've taken the traditional race card and removed all the jargon and abbreviations, which can be daunting for newcomers. The result is a race card that means making informed choices and picking winners is easier than ever. Our racing experts and data scientists have created an algorithm that puts everything a seasoned punter would consider into the attribute bars you see on the race card and assesses each runner with an overall score out of 100.
Welcome back. We turn now to the Jockey Club. Older than the United States, the Jockey Club is the racecourse group that runs some of Britain's most iconic tracks, Cheltenham, Aintree, Epsom, Newmarket. In a deeply reported article in Sunday's newspaper, Lee Modishead spoke to numerous members of the Jockey Club and revealed remarkable levels of internal unrest following various setbacks, including a second consecutive year in which crowds dropped at the Cheltenham Festival and which precipitated a cut to prize money. Lee, tell us more about what you uncovered for your article.
So I think the situation that we have now and we have had for a number of weeks and months is an unprecedented level of tension between the individuals who are elected members of the private members club, that is the Jockey Club, and the paid executive that runs the business. Now, that paid executive is actually a recent thing. Simon Bazalgette was the first group CEO of the Jockey Club, and that's within the last 20 years. It's a relatively modern phenomenon.
It probably helps people to understand a little bit about this very unique organisation. Yep. Obviously, it has evolved from the Jockey Club, a private members club, which is founded in 1750 and remains to this day a private members club. But then the organisation formerly ran the sport, but now continues to run a number of race courses, while simultaneously continuing as a private members club, answerable to its members rather than to shareholders or anything of that nature.
Yeah, so the structure of the Jockey Club, you say, used to be the governing body. It was then the governing body and the regulator until the creation of the... was the governing body until the creation of the BHB in 1993. Then it maintained a regulatory control of the sport from the 12, 13, 14 years. These days, as an organisation, as you say, it runs 15 racecourses, including Cheltenham, Epsom, Aintree, Newmarket. It has the three training centres, Newmarket, Epsom and Lambourne. It has the National Stud, Racing Welfare, property portfolio, including the Jockey Club rooms. If you go on any booking website, you can stay there now as well. So it has an awful lot at its disposal. It is a big landowner, a big property owner. It's a powerful organisation, but it is a private members club. So there are less than 200 members. Most are normal elected members. Some are honorary members. If you are a member of the Jockey Club, you pay £725 a year for your membership. In return, you will get very nice hospitality on big race days. A number of them actually put a lot back into the sport as non-paid members of racecourse committees or as racecourse chairs or on the nine strong board of stewards, which in effect is the Jockey Club's board of directors. They are plucked from the membership and in effect they have the ultimate power working with their paid executive. The current chief executive is Nevin Truesdale, who 3.5 years ago took over from Delia Bushell, who was the subject of many a Racing Post headline during her short tenure as Jockey Club chief executive. She was appointed by Sandy Dudgeon, the senior steward, who remains senior steward and will do until July, and he also appointed Nevin Truesdale. The problem we've had in recent months has been this growing tension between the membership and the executive. It applies on a number of levels. You referenced Cheltenham, Tom. That ignited a discontent that was simmering in relation to Cheltenham. It wasn't simply that attendance had fallen for the second year running, and on this occasion, caused the Jockey Club to cut prize money, prize money contribution by £750,000, although the actual loss to the Jockey Club of the lost Cheltenham attendees was actually many millions of pounds, so many multiples more than that prize money cut. The membership were frustrated that the Jockey Club hadn't better foreseen the likely fall in attendance. Last year, you'll recall, there was a reliance, or there was an emphasis on train strikes as having been a big factor. The Jockey Club overestimated that. The Jockey Club now acknowledges that it got some pricing points wrong towards the best mate and task force enclosure. So there was annoyance about that from the membership. There was annoyance that the Jockey Club executive had even gone into a process of examining whether there should be a fifth day festival, because many of the members seemed to feel it was never a realistic option. So why you look at it? So the Cheltenham was something that fueled discontent, but it was already there, because for some time a number of senior high profile members who I spoke to off the record and whose names, if they're on the record, would be well known racing figures, they have felt that the executive has adopted a policy of centralisation, of increased control at the centre of the Jockey Club, that has been damaging to the racecourses, and particularly the smaller racecourses that form the backbone of the Jockey Club. They point to things like sponsorship, whereby now the Jockey Club will have a lot of central sponsorship contracts with organisations. And if, for example, the Jockey Club has a central contract with a cider producer, a local track like an Exeter, a Wincanton or a Market Raisin, if it had a local cider producer, they would in all probability not be able to sponsor a race because a wider sponsor is in place. And the tracks say, well, look, that local sponsor is at the heart of our community, would be really valuable to us, but we can't have it because there's this big name brand that wants to do no activation on the track and really means nothing to our local racegoers. So there's that bone of discontent. It's been fueled by a sense that the Jockey Club has not just increased the size of the centre, but has made, has created roles and put people in those roles that they feel are not appropriate to the Jockey Club. They feel that some of the roles that have been created make the Jockey Club look more like a Google or an Amazon than the Jockey Club, and they dislike the fact that a number of the people appointed from their perspective, and Nevin Truesdale, the chief executive, acknowledges to me, don't really have much interest, or not, they're not engaged with racing, they're not massive fans of racing. Within a 90-minute conversation I had with Nevin, there were a number of interesting points raised, discussed. He acknowledged from his perspective that, yes, centralisation probably had gone too far and they need to rebalance, and they will and have listened to members. He also acknowledged the Cheltenham situation could get worse before it gets better. He refused to rule out the potential for racecourse sales, although he did say that there probably wouldn't be any acquisitions for the time being. And also, interestingly, he was very open and transparent in saying that we can't rule out the Jockey Club perhaps at some point emulating what the Six Nations have done and selling a part of the business to private equity. And there was also an interesting discussion about Kempton on Boxing Day. You'll remember that attendances have fallen at Kempton on Boxing Day since COVID, yet the Jockey Club are adamant publicly that the number of tickets they've sold are pretty much the same as before COVID. And there was an interesting discussion on as to why that might be the case, and a reference of inflation, significant inflation of the number of comps that were recorded before COVID. So lots of interesting discussion points. Yeah. Since then, I penned a column in the Post on Monday that tried to shine the spotlight more on the members and highlight that for the moment, the membership is not publicly available. You can't find out, I can't find out a complete list of the Jockey Club members. For me, that feels wrong. I think the Jockey Club has to work on the perception of that, and also the perception of its political situation, in that you have a strange situation at the moment whereby you've got Sandy Dudgeon, a Conservative donor, who is handing over to Baroness Harding, a Conservative peer who's married to a Conservative MP, just as the Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, in all probability sweeps to power with a huge majority. So lots of things to discuss.
Lots going on there, and I think, you know, what's really important to stress is that, you know, hitherto there was not public knowledge that there was this degree of unhappiness and unrest within the Jockey Club. We all obviously knew that there'd been cuts to prize money and other cuts to the Jockey Club's operating budget, but we didn't realise there was quite such a divide between the executive and at least elements of the members.
Which Nevin believes to be a minority, but they're clearly a vocal minority if that is the case.
So the first question is, how do we expect this to unfold over the coming months? I mean, where does it leave Nevin Truesdale and the rest of his executive team?
Well, if you look first of all at Nevin Truesdale as chief executive, I think even among the people who I spoke to who have been and are extremely critical of centralisation and have issues with Cheltenham and elsewhere, I think there is an acknowledgement that they like him. They see him as a good guy who has meant to do good things, and they appreciate the manner in which he has gone out on
obviously
the front foot.
Put his name to the petition against the affordability chair. He's been very public around defending the Grand National.
Absolutely. So when the sport was being attacked by Animal Rising, more than any other administrator or racing leader, he was the one who was on TV batting for racing. Yeah. So I think there is a lot of respect and they like Nevin Truesdale, and I don't think a lot of them want him to go. I think that they want him there. And I think there is also, if you look at it politically, you have a situation whereby Sandy Dudgeon has a 5-year tenure as senior steward. He has already appointed and dismissed one chief executive in Delia Bushell. I'm not sure one senior steward in a 5-year term would want to appoint and dismiss two chief executives. So whilst there will be rumours about Nevin Truesdale's position, I think there is still a groundswell of support for him. However, I think Nevin has acknowledged in our conversation that centralisation went too far and they have to move back on that. So it will be interesting to see if members believe he's moving back at a quick enough rate and to a point at which they become satisfied. And I think there's also, Tom, a need from the perspective of some members for them to feel that they are being better listened to. Because what you have to remember is that although the Jockey Club membership has a lot of long-term owner breeders, members of royalty, etc., etc. It also these days has a number of high-powered, influential business people who've achieved great things in their own walks of life. Mm. And I think some of them feel that what they believe they can bring to the table isn't being sufficiently acknowledged.
And I think, you know, we talk a lot on this show, regrettably, about how racing has some impossible sort of structures, you know, the power of veto in the sport as a whole. And obviously one of the things that I was focused on in your article with some of the people you spoke to was the difficulty the Jockey Club was having dealing with its unique power structure, which I think leads me to the crucial question, which I put to both of you, which is that in 2024, should a private members club be effectively running the sport's most iconic race courses?
I think there is, as you imply there, there is definitely an argument to say that the Jockey Club now does not have a structure and makeup that will see it through in the long term. The column I wrote today was heavily leaning towards the question of perception. What you've discussed there, Tom, is the fact that the perception of a private members club having that amount of power and influence in the sport, I don't think is a good look in itself. I think it needs to evolve. I think if it's going to retain the structure of a private members club, it has to be a hell of a lot less private, and it has to have a different sort of membership, one that more reflects racing as a whole and not just a section of racing. If you're trying to defend the status quo, I think some Jockey Club members would say, because we are different as a structure, we can take a bigger picture. One thing that was said to me was that a number of members believe the Jockey Club can be too keen to take a purely commercial outlook on something, and that it's the Jockey Club's role sometimes to be less influenced by what is the commercial imperative. One story that was told to me by a number of people, two or three people, was in relation to Epsom, which was described twice to me as the problem child of the Jockey Club, place very dear to my heart. I live down the road, dear to all our hearts. We all love the Derby. Mm. But Epsom isn't working as well as it should do. It has only two days of any real significance in terms of horse racing. Attendances outside of the Derby Festival are not great. The Derby Festival in itself makes money, but outside of that, the track doesn't do well commercially.
I find amazing given the catchment area.
But it doesn't do well. As a local resident, I know that the there isn't the community link with the town that you would get elsewhere. They tried to address that. So 2 years ago, there was a community day on the Thursday evening before Oaks Day. I'd hope that might come back again this year or in future years, but the track doesn't work particularly well commercially, to the extent that when the current grandstand, the new grandstand, the Duchess grandstand was built late in the noughties, some people suggested, can we justify building a new grandstand on a racecourse that is doing or is failing to perform as it should do commercially? Can we justify that? Would we be better off actually having temporary structures instead of a grandstand? Or would we even be better off ceasing to run Epsom as a racecourse instead?
There was just a serious conversation about shutting
Epsom. There was a conversation, and it was certainly suggested in some quarters that that make more sense. The Jockey Club would say, the membership would say, well, look, it's because we are different that we said, no, we can't do that. We accept that Epsom doesn't perform well financially, but Epsom is the home of the Derby, and the Derby has to remain.
It's a bit like saying, though, we consider the 20-day Cheltenham Festival, but don't worry, we decided not to do it. It's not necessarily going to cover you. Anyway,
you're not getting a round of applause for that one, are you?
We probably shouldn't dwell on what I hope was a very briefly considered prospect of shutting Epsom. What do you think, Chris? I mean, where now for the Jockey Club? Is it fit for purpose in its current form, or does the Jockey Club need to evolve once again, as it has done over the past 250 years, in order to be fit for the future?
I don't object to a bit of evolution, certainly not transparency either. You have to give the Jockey Club a lot of credit for, you know, historically, you know, doing a pretty good job of the caretaking.
I mean, saving Cheltenham, saving Aintree.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation you've described is clearly alarming, but maybe it was just one of those blue sky conversations that people like to have sometimes. I mean, they did a really alarming thing when they basically announced they were going to shut Kempton and build on it. And they presented that initially as a done deal. And then, you know, it was made clear to them that that could not be the case. And thankfully, that no longer seems to be in anybody's thoughts.
Well, it isn't. But equally, part of the problem now is that the Jug Club is in a rough financial position.
As we all are.
Yeah, but there are big pockets of land around Kempton that could be sold for housing.
But they've struggled with all of them. I mean, they tried to do the same with Sandown, little snippets, trying to get.
I think Kempton would be easier, but I think there is a feeling that because they balls that up previously so badly.
The goodwill isn't there. Yeah.
But they're not ruling out doing something in the future. And if it was done right, you know, if you did sell pockets of land that aren't used for racing and wouldn't impact on the racing business, you could actually bring in a heck of a lot of money. But I said, because it went so badly wrong before, I think they're a bit scarred by it.
Anyway, I mean, you know, if you talk to trainers in Lambourne or Newmarket, you know, they're full of praise for what the Jockey Club's done to improve their facilities. And, you know, that sort of investing in the sport, you know, in a way that anybody could approve of. And they've done lots of great things. I'd like to hear something about the sort of, there must be a cultural divide, mustn't there, at the Jockey Club, as everywhere else in racing, between flat racing and jump racing, right? I mean, it's interesting to me that, you know, they have Cheltenham and they have the Grand National, producing a huge amount of money, a fair bit of which, it seems to me, ends up sort of helping to fund Newmarket. And, you know, you'd like to know that those decisions that are being made are by people who have jump racing's best interests at heart as well as flat racing. You know, in the sort of darkest suspicions of jump racing fans, I'm sure there are folk out there who imagine that these major jumps festivals are sort of irrigating the flat racing.
Well, again, that's an interesting point you raise, because one of the industry figures I spoke to described jump racing as a flashing light for the Jug Club, because this won't come as a surprise to anyone, but there are senior industry figures who do worry that jump racing potentially might have a shorter shelf life than any of us would like. They don't want that to be the case, but they acknowledge that that might at some point be an issue on the table. And for the Jockey Club, there is a problem.
On what table? I mean, they're not going to talk the game into its grave.
No. I generally don't believe that any of them wants that to be the case. But I think equally, they see debates around the Grand National and fatalities, and they wonder if at some point it might be a fight that they have to have with other people. I think there's a
if they want to win, they shouldn't present it as a fight.
Well, no, but that they're my words, not. I don't know. But I think that there is a commercial feeling in the Jockey Club that even if you put that to one side, commercially, it is heavily entrenched in jump racing, particularly in the Cheltenham Festival is by far and away its biggest revenue driver, which is why attendance falls matter so much.
Yeah.
And when they're so heavily entrenched in jump racing, and when some of their flat product isn't performing as well commercially as they would want it to, how do you tackle that?
Lee, last word on this. As you said, Dido Harding coming in as the senior steward very shortly. The suggestion that she's going to take a radical approach. Yeah. What do we anticipate seeing when we have this change of senior steward?
Yeah, it was said to me that they envisaged that Dido Harding would be radical. Again, she comes into the job with a big business background, some things that have gone well, some things that haven't gone so well, and that's a fact too, because she does bring baggage the role. But I think she will want to be a hands-on chair. Part of the problem at the minute is that I don't think there would have been many candidates for the role. It was put to me that Dido Harding had questions herself about taking the role. May or may not be true. Another steward, William White, was said to be the other contender for the senior steward's role. But I'm not sure there was a field the size of the Cambridgeshire wanting to come out the gates to chase the job, because, you know, it's a bit like if you're coming into Downing Street anytime soon, you're not necessarily inheriting a great situation. It's a difficult time, and difficult decisions will have to be made. But yes, so radical was what I was told they thought Brad Harding would be.
Can I just ask about, there was a sort of fleeting mention of a part sale to private equity that really worried me. I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you, like Harold Macmillan, was it you said, you can only sell a family silver once. I mean, that's pretty alarming to me.
Yeah.
Because you lose control and you get a short-term injection of funds.
Yeah.
But then that's gone.
Yeah.
And you're owned.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this was something that I put to Nevin Trews, I suppose, that he put to me. And he certainly wasn't saying anything was on the table. There is nothing on the table, he was saying, but they wouldn't necessarily rule anything out or take anything off the table should it get onto the table. Mm. I think they acknowledge, or he believes, that there is a need for the Jockey Club to diversify commercially. I think there's an emphasis on the Jockey Club being not just a racing business, but it has a big property portfolio. And I think they feel that they need to make that property work better for them. And that includes where you have racecourses like Exeter that would probably be used 320 days a year. So on non-race days, that is a heavily used racecourse, but not all the racecourses, including Epsom Moor. So I think they feel they need to diversify in that front. And I think because of the current commercial situation, albeit the debt has come down a lot, I think they feel they have to be open-minded in their outlook in terms of how the business might be shaped in the future.
Right, we're going to have to call it there, guys. If you want to gain access to Lee's special report on the Jockey Club, and indeed to get access to all of our fantastic reporting on horse racing, the industry on which it depends, then please join Members Club Ultimate, our premium subscription tier. Your support really is appreciated. And to find out a little bit more about Members Club, this ad's coming up now.
Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post Members Club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips from the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keeley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months.
Welcome back. Last week, our France correspondent Scott Burton exclusively broke the news that Olivier Pellier, one of the most stylish and gifted jockeys of his generation, was bringing his career in the saddle to a close. That sent Chris Cook down a little bit of an internet rabbit hole, trying to access some of the great races from Pellier's career. And you're a little bit disappointed by what you found, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I was just trying to put myself in the position of some relative newcomer to racing as a fan. And suddenly there's all this coverage about Olivier Pellier, who probably, if you've only joined us within the last 10 years as a British-based fan, you might not have come into contact with him all that much. He hasn't been that prolific. You know, back in the day, won 3 consecutive arcs, and it was a really big deal. And so you're suddenly aware from all of these reports and the extent of the nice things that people say that he was that significant character. You want to find out more. Where do you go on the internet to try and find that out? As I said, you know, football fans have it easy. So if you want to find out about the significance of Robbie Fowler, say, go on Wikipedia or, you know, any of a number of other websites, and there's just screeds of information out there. And racing isn't so lucky because it doesn't have the same profile. So to take Wikipedia as an example, Pellier's Wikipedia page is just a list of the big races that he won. And some of them are on YouTube, but by no means all of them, and not even all of the sort of the British ones that you might expect. There were a lot of racing-related videos on YouTube at one time, you know, footage of great old races that we would love to watch, that got culled suddenly when one of the rights holders...
Almost before, the bonfire of the YouTube replays in about 2009, 2010 or something. It was
and suddenly, you know, really significant races, you couldn't find the footage anywhere. So it bugs me, as it has done for a long time, that the sport centrally isn't making that kind of use of its heritage, especially footage of old racing replays, but other things as well, as a means of entertaining its existing fans and potentially bringing in new people. You know, there's a huge amount of scope for things that could be done there. And in these days, with the tech that we have,
done fairly readily, as long as you can deal with issues like, you know, who owns the rights to these footage. I suspect that we haven't ever, you know, as a sport, been forward-thinking enough to start including clauses in contracts along the lines of, you know, well, Racing TV, it's great to have you, and thanks so much for the job that you do on behalf of the sport, but sometimes we will borrow bits of your footage and use them purely for the promotion of horse racing, from which you also benefit. That kind of work should be done, I feel, and in other sports it is done. As I say, as a way of, you know, and it would help to keep people informed. It helps to build the sort of lore that we all use when we talk to each other about horse racing. It just creates a more interesting culture. I'm sure it would help to increase our audience if we, you know, you could even do a little bit of work in this direction. It would make a difference.
And you highlighted the Hall of Fame, which launched a few years ago.
Right.
A great initiative, but you sort of pointed out perhaps a few flaws.
It was absolutely necessary. I was so pleased they did it with funding from KIPCO. Great. It's only flat racing. A jump racing, you know, I think a jump racing Hall of Fame would really thrive as well. And it's not bricks and mortar. It's only online. It's progressed so slowly. I think there's only 20 people and horses in there now, and it's been going for about 3 years. They obviously decided at the outset they were going to introduce sort of two or three people at a time at a couple of different points of the season, and they make a big thing of it. And it's done to a very high standard what's there, but the website is not as easy to use as it could be.
They don't have an A to Z list.
But that's a bit weird to me. When you get to the list of the Hall of Famers, you have to keep scrolling through them all to find out who's in there, you know, and so that's a lot of effort. But then they put together some of these videos about the guys every time they induct somebody. There's a sort of lovely 4 or 5 minute video, people talking to camera, some clips from their old races, you know, great fun, good high quality stuff. And that would be quite a good introduction to some of these people for newcomers to the sport. But even then, they're not making the absolute best use of the old footage that they could. I mean, I gave the example, I was sitting through the Willie Carson video, and it's like 90 seconds before you even get to seeing a horse. I mean, that can't be right, can it? You know, there's got to be a sort of much more attacking, aggressive, muscular way of putting these things together, where you're seeing immediately lots of footage of Willie in action and that sort of familiar riding style he used to have. And the amazing ride on Erhard, which he actually describes, but then they don't show, of him sort of in this enormous pack of horses, but sticking to the rail and basically yelling at jockeys to get out of his way as he progresses through the pack. It's a good thing. I'm grateful for it, but there's more to do. And in particular, I just wish there was somebody at the heart of the sport who could pick up that ball and run with it, because there's so much scope there.
And on that note, we're going to have to leave it. So it falls to me now to determine what goes on the front page of the front page. There would certainly be a very strong case for Willie Mullins and his historic achievement, but I think Willie's probably had enough front pages this year, so we're going to go with Unrest at the Jockey Club. A fantastic piece of reporting by Lee, and a really important story about one of the most important institutions in British racing. That's a wrap for this week. Thank you very much to my panel, Lee Modishead and Chris Cook. Been fantastic to have you. Thank you at home for joining us and for your likes, comments and subscribes. Always appreciated. Please do come back and join us again next week, where we'll be digesting the Punchdown Festival. And indeed, stay tuned to the Racing Post YouTube channels and all of our other platforms throughout the week, as we'll be giving in-depth coverage to the last hurrah of the jump season. Thanks again. Goodbye.